today, talking to Armando Iannucci, the creator of The Thick of It and Veep, about how hard it's become to satirise politics today. And the tragic death of basketball superstar Kobe Bryant. Sometimes among political journalists, the kind of thing that we say now, you know, once we used to say it's not Watergate, now we say we're literally living in the thick of it. I mean, have we just reached a place where you couldn't make it up?
Well, except the thick of it is very benign, you know, on reflection.
Armando Iannucci is one of Britain's leading satirists.
See, you are a omni-shambles, that's what you are.
He uses comedy to lay bare the state of contemporary politics in the UK and America.
New party logo, a kitten in a sock, sitting on a motorway shouting, help me, I don't know what to do, am I getting close?
And yet, as we emerge from perhaps the most tumultuous period in Westminster and Washington for generations, he's turned his attention elsewhere, to completely different periods of time. Rewinding back almost 200 years to Charles Dickens' Britain in an adaptation of David Copperfield, and fast-forwarding 40 years into the future with a new comedy based in space, Avenue 5. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, Armando Iannucci on how modern politics has gone beyond satire.
Obviously, you became most famous for satirising politics in this country.
Yes.
I mean, I've been a political reporter for a number of years, and the last 3 years have been unbelievable.
I thought you were going to say unpleasant.
Quite unpleasant, too. I mean, why haven't you been writing about it?
Satire only works if there's a series of accepted conventions, and then you point out when politicians or people in the public have departed from those conventions. But if the politicians are saying, there are no more conventions anymore, I can do what the hell I like, I can change the name of my party to Fact Check UK, it's very difficult for someone to point out where those conventions have been breached.
What?
You did what? You set up a bank.
I had a moment of weakness and they exploited it, like Hugh Grant.
You bought a bank out of social embarrassment. I sometimes buy the big issue out of social embarrassment.
The situation is so feral at the moment. I'll only be able to make sense of it in about 10 years' time.
What have been the jaw-dropping moments that you've noticed over the past few years?
Well, I mentioned the fact-check thing. I mean, it's like saying the Ministry of Truth, really, isn't it?
Can I ask about the Conservative Party's decision to change its online Twitter feed to Fact Check UK? Does that undermine trust in the Conservative Party?
Well, Rowena, I'm afraid that the Twitter sphere is not really my province. But what I can say is that I'm informed that
that's why aren't we jumping up and down? Why aren't we arresting them for deceit? You know, it's things like that.
As I say, when it comes to trust in politics...
I mean, this is the idea that you've talked about, that, you know, politicians are becoming comedians, journalists are becoming politicians.
Yes.
Is it all blurry?
We've all moved round one, isn't it? You know, journalists have become politicians, politicians become comedians, and comedians have become journalists. There you go.
So I'm in Parliament right now.
You should be standing,
yeah,
yes.
Definitely. Yes.
What we need to know, there is one giant fact that, which we continue to chase down. There is one elusive, like the hunting of the snark, or the quest for the answer to Fermat's last theorem, or the riddle of the Sphinx, or the Bermuda Triangle.
Now, as politicians think, oh, social media, we'll have that. Don't need to do the BBC anymore. Don't need to go on the Today programme. Don't need to talk to journalists. We'll do our own journalists. I'll call Michael Gove a journalist now. We lose this sense of independent arbiters of information, someone who's going, these facts are quite important, so we're going to put them your way. And instead we get, these facts are ones you probably like, so we'll send them your way. And these other ones that you probably don't like, we won't even alert you to them.
And what's the danger and the impact of that?
Well, the impact, I think, is that we then retreat to our own kind of comfort zone and only converse with people who sort of agree with us. I think in real life, we're losing that sense of wanting to have a disagreement. You know, if you disagree with me, the tendency is to say, and therefore, could you please leave, rather than, no, I disagree with you, and here's the points I disagree with you on.
And you found that particularly hard when you were criticising Corbyn.
Well, exactly. You know, I'd say, I'd make a remark about Corbyn and, I don't know, anti-Semitism or something, and I'd get this whole kind of ladder of vitriol from, oh, so you'd rather have fascists in charge. You want children to die, do you? Which I don't think was the subtext of my kind of attack on anti-Semitism.
I can understand that politics has gone in a direction that makes it almost difficult to create satire around. But there are some fascinating characters within it. One of those is a person like Dominic Cummings.
Absolutely.
I mean, love him or loathe him, he must be an absolute gift to someone
like
but
you. We did something like that with Stuart Pearson in Thick of It.
You know, I spent 10 years detoxifying this party. It's been a bit like renovating an old, old house. Yeah? You can take out a sexist beam here, a callous window there, replace the odd homophobic roof tile. But after a while, you realise that this renovation is doomed.
Do you know who you would cast as him?
As who? Probably some kind of animal. I don't know. Some kind of... Does it have to be human? I don't know.
You've obviously spent quite a few years writing about US politics. I mean, it's a big year. Watching the presidential race, I just wondered who'd be your pick from the Democratic nominees.
Well, as a writer, Bernie Sanders would give us a lot to play with.
My job today is to put together a team that can defeat the most dangerous president in the history of the United States of America.
Elizabeth Warren would give us a lot to play with.
We just have this extraordinary moment. All we have to do is open our hearts and work our rear ends off, and we can make this happen.
I'm not sure how much Joe Biden would give us a lot. See, Joe Biden is the chicken. You know, if in doubt, ask for chicken at a restaurant.
Second option.
I suspect that's what will happen.
Is that the same here with the Labour race?
Well, the Keir Starmer is the chicken option.
Or Lisa Nandy. Who knows what
Lisa
the chicken
Nandy,
is?
Yes. Nandy and Nando's. There must be a headline there. If only we could find it. Embracing the chicken option.
But that's not the kind of snappy one-liner that Iannucci is trying to come up with right now. Because while he's still watching politics closely and certainly tweeting about it, professionally, he's been looking back to see how the state of modern Britain echoes Dickensian society.
This narrative is far more than mere fiction.
Are you David Copperfield?
I am indeed.
It is the true story of the life I was about to lead.
Your mama is ill.
How ill is she?
Very ill.
Dangerously ill.
She's dead.
When did you first read David Copperfield?
I must have been about 15 or 16. And it was only when I reread it about 9 years ago, I instantly thought, I want to make this as a film. This is such a modern book, really. The whole thing is about the search for self, really, personal identity. I mean, the opening line is...
Whether I turn out to be the hero of my own story, or whether that station will be held by anybody else.
It's all about, who am I? This very, very modern theme of status anxiety and imposter syndrome.
You should be thanking me, Daisy.
My name is David. Not Daisy, not Trot. My name is David Copperfield.
Then why don't you go by it?
Do I fit in, basically? That's what David's asking himself all the time.
I mean, there's also a lot about class. I mean, you depict...
Yes, status. Yes.
Status, yeah. So you depict Copperfield going to this private school.
Yes.
And he's surrounded by privileged pupils who mock their teacher.
And his way of surviving is to mock the teacher even more.
Sniggering, gentlemen. Hilarity. In short, ha-ha. I don't think so.
And also we looked at the whole landlord situation, which hasn't changed much since 1840. Dickens describes the properties being subdivided and subdivided so much that it seemed to be like an effort to cram as many people as possible into the smallest space possible.
Yeah, I did wonder as well whether your sweeping shots that showed rough sleepers were a way of trying to...
Well, yes, because that obviously that would have been the case now, but also signalling that David's fortunes and misfortunes chime with, you know, the rhythms of a lot of lives today.
Do you live on the streets now?
Well, we do currently exist primarily al fresco, but with all the advantages that entails.
That's happening more and more, you know, talking to Shelter about the state of homelessness, not just on the streets, but whole families in bed and breakfasts. They're not those sort of typical stories that the stereotype stories of people who are on drugs or whatever. It's somebody losing a job all of a sudden. These change of circumstances, brutal changes, are happening overnight.
But how can you be ruined?
Like a big castle.
Because I've lost everything, Trot. In the mining way and the banking way.
Mining.
Mr. Wickfield cannot fully explain why, but our money is gone.
And I guess there's a big statement in race, not in the writing, but in the casting. You've been completely colourblind. I was watching it with someone who was asking whether it was significant that the child was Asian, to which I was saying, no, I think it's meant to be completely insignificant. But they said that because it's unusual, especially in period drama. I mean, did anyone push back against you doing that?
No, absolutely not. Well, first of all, I could only imagine Dev Patel playing David Copperfield. He, for me, just inhabited the spirit of David. When I saw him in Line be very strong and centered and focused, I immediately thought that's David Copperfield. And there was a brief moment when you think, okay, so do we rewrite it to say his father was Indian? And I thought, no, I just want to cast people the same way I cast David, which is just find the right person for the part. And if we are going to be making an industry out of doing period pieces and so on, I think we have to make a case now for saying we can't do it like the way it's always been done. I'm also aware of a fantastic new generation of actors who I don't want to read headlines about saying they had to go to America to get decent roles, you know. It's about that. And it's interesting. It's a question that comes up from people before they've seen the film, and it goes away as soon as they've seen the film.
I mean, I've got another question on it though, having seen the film, which I'll ask. I mean, I read that you hadn't realised how white and male your casting was until you were filming in Baltimore for Veep. I mean, you're heralded as the kind of godfather of satire in this country. You make stars. And I guess if it took that for you to see that, does that mean that you, maybe all of us, have a kind of deeply embedded unconscious bias?
Absolutely. I've always prided myself in things like Think of It and Veep, or female characters, and working with really, you know, putting them, you know, so I always thought I kind of got that right.
Being vice president is like being declawed, defanged, neutered.
But it was working in Baltimore and then realizing coming home how very white the Thick of It is. Partridge, and you know, and
do you think that has an impact? I mean, do you feel a bit of guilt about that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If I was doing it again now, I'd probably be casting it differently, but I wouldn't be using like a quota or something. I'd just be saying, okay, the advisor, I want to cast from 100% of the acting community available to me here. You know, there's that terrible liberal thing of thinking because you think you're liberal, you're good and you're therefore perfect, and you're not, you know, you're really not.
Is Britain a good place to nurture the next generation of comedy writers and actors?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're blessed with having a fantastic comedy tradition here. It's why America comes here to make all the Star Wars films, and Marvel comes here to make all its movies.
Do you feel a responsibility in terms of your casting?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think we have been slightly snobbish here about people who are just TV, as it were, quote, just TV.
That's changed, hasn't it?
No, I think it still exists. I think there's still an element of, you know, you have your film actors and you have your television actors. Oh, hey. I, for example, in my last two films, have used Paul Whitehouse because I think he's one of our best actors.
Look at all that sky, eh, Davey boy? That's too much sky, isn't it? Even for a bird.
Really. And I wish more people would use them in that capacity.
Do you know what I feel? People look to television now in a way that they never did before.
But I'm talking about nationally. I think there's still within the British film industry a tendency to think that British TV actors are not quite as film as film actors.
Just on that, I just really thought you were very interesting on the BBC, because there's a big question now about its future.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel worried about the BBC?
I do, because, you know, I argued in the McTaggart lecture about 4 or 5 years ago for it to go big internationally and really sell itself internationally on its name and its tradition. I worry that they might have missed the boat on that, because Netflix now and Amazon have such a hold and such a huge kind of checkbook financed by massive debt in the case of Netflix. But there is a danger that they just suck up all the talent. And I think we'd be missing out if we didn't have a British broadcaster who's still able to nurture that talent. The way out in the short term will be to do partnerships with HBO and with Amazon and Hulu and so on. But I think those big companies, and they're all American, still regard the BBC and Channel 4 and, you know, British television generally as the gold standard, which is why they want to come here and make the stuff here. So I think we should be capitalizing on that even more.
Bridge crew, listen up. I need a course back to Earth. There's a lot of people counting on us to get them there.
Iannucci's new show, Avenue 5, takes us 40 years into the future, where a team of hapless cadets, led by Hugh Laurie, is forging its way into the space tourism industry.
No man left behind.
Dead or alive?
No, alive or alive?
When you think 40 years into the future, what do you think might be happening on Earth?
Well, there's the occasional reference to things that may have happened in the kind of preceding 40 years that we just drop as little kind of jokes that you have to kind of then imagine, like the Huawei wars and...
Actual wars.
And somebody says, I'm just listening to a podcast about that Greta Gerwig thing. And somebody else says, yeah, everyone's got a theory about that, haven't they? You just wonder what the hell that was. You know, it's kind of little things like that. But actually, as the season progresses and as we get into later season, we do... I mean, the White House is now in Buffalo, so something's clearly happened to the eastern seaboard. And as we progress, we find out a little bit more about what might have happened on Earth.
So climate crisis.
The kind of thinking behind something like Avenue 5 is to look at that sense of, you know, 6,500 people in this pressure cooker in space having to start again and try to work together to get themselves out of the problem. So what happens if they don't work together? What happens if you have people who are obstructing that, really?
I think I read somewhere you've got two new projects underway. What are they?
Have I?
Two secret ones?
I've got... I've got several film scripts that are written.
Can you tell us about any of those film scripts?
Well, one is a comedy about artificial intelligence and robots.
Are you shifting from comedy more to journalism, I guess?
I don't know. I mean, all these things, you know, I want to be funny. You know, the robots will be funny because they're not quite ready. But mentally, they think they're ready to rise up. Physically, they're still having trouble opening a door.
What makes you fascinated about AI?
Well, because it's looming, really. You know, if you want to talk about, you know, the state of the world at the moment, that's going to have such a significant impact. And also, if you want to talk about power, power is now residing more and more in the Googles and Facebooks of this world because they have information. They have all our details. And I think that's actually, you know, my next contemporary setting will be in that world, because I think that's a world that I want to investigate further, really, as to how it's affecting us.
Armando, thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was Armando Iannucci. His new film, The Personal History of David Copperfield, is out now in cinemas. And you can watch Avenue 5 by HBO on Sky. Coming up, a helicopter crash kills basketball legend Kobe Bryant. Now, Sunday saw the tragic news that 41-year-old American basketball superstar Kobe Bryant had died in a helicopter crash in the Los Angeles Hills. With a stellar basketball career spanning 20 years, Kobe was an inspiration for many, particularly African Americans, and an international ambassador for the sport. But his reputation was also tarnished by a 2003 allegation of rape. Here's The Guardian's US deputy sports editor, Brian Armand Graham.
Kobe Bryant was one of the greatest basketball players of all time, one of the great American athletes of all time, really up there with Michael Jordan. It's stunning that we lose him at the height of his fame. On Sunday, around 9:00 local time, a Sikorsky helicopter that Bryant owned departed from an airport in Orange County, California, with 9 occupants aboard, including his 13-year-old daughter, Gigi, Gianna. And there was light rain and foggy weather all morning that was causing the LAPD helicopters in the area to be grounded. what actually happened that caused the crash is subject to the investigation that's ongoing. But what we do know is that the helicopter crashed into the side of a mountain in Calabasas, about 30 miles from Los Angeles, and caught on fire, and all 9 passengers aboard died. When you assess Kobe Bryant as a player, the sort of raw achievements speak for themselves. He was an 18-time All-Star. He was a 12-time member of the All-Defensive Team, 5-time NBA champion. He was an absolute killer as a shooting guard. He was very much modeled his game deliberately after Michael Jordan, which is much easier said than done. And his stardom reached well beyond Los Angeles. He's believed to have sold more jerseys internationally than any other player but Michael Jordan. He was very instrumental in raising the league's international profile. He could conduct interviews in Spanish and Italian. You know, Michael Phelps might have won 8 gold medals at the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, but on the ground, the star of those games was Kobe Bryant. His death has caused an outpouring of reaction. Everything from heads of state, Barack Obama, Donald Trump chimed in, and when you talk about his impact among the African-American community, he ended up taking the pop star brandy to the prom. And to a certain segment, you know, he was sort of black royalty at the age of 17. They became these sort of iconic couple at the time.
Despite all his sporting achievements and cultural significance, I don't think we can talk about Kobe without discussing the fact that he was accused of sexual assault in 2003, an event that leaves a long shadow over his legacy and really tarnished his reputation and the public's perception of him.
He was arrested on an investigation of a sexual assault complaint by a hotel employee in Eagle, Colorado. She had stated that Bryant raped her in his hotel room. On the eve of the trial, she decided not to testify. But afterward, Bryant tearfully in the courtroom agreed to apologize, and it was very much a mea culpa. What he said was, "Although I truly believe this encounter between us was consensual, I recognize now that she did not and does not view this incident the same way that I did."
After that, in 2005, the civil suit that the accuser had filed against Bryant resulted in an undisclosed financial settlement.
That was Brian Armand Graham. You can read more about this story at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.